I'm Mike Dinn. I was the Deputy Station Director at Honeysuckle Creek during Apollo's 7 through 13. And also I worked on Apollo 17. Apollo 8, that was, up till that point, certainly that was the highlight of my career. And even today, when we look back on it, it really was an unbelievably ambitious, gutsy decision and execution. Luckily, everything went to plan. But anyway, my role was to, as Deputy Director at Honeysuckle, was to run the operations. That meant sitting on the desk and sort of supervising the operations in real time. I had previously had experience at Tidbinbilla in a similar role, and on the Surveyor missions. The Surveyor was the first soft landing on the moon, and the technology as regards transmitting and receiving was almost identical for Apollo. Therefore, my experience led over readily to the operations at Honeysuckle. And we supported Apollo 7. Apollo 7 was an Earth-orbiting manned flight where we were part of the network, but we were only one small element in the network. In Earth orbit, the passes took 3 or 4 minutes, and we were skilled enough at that, but we were just part of the 20-odd stations. But after Apollo 7, I was asked, did I think we had the competence and experience to support a lunar mission before Christmas? This would have been somewhere about in September, October, thereabouts. And given my previous experience at Tidbinbilla, given the competence we'd shown on Apollo 7, I confidently said, yes, I think we can support Apollo 8. So that's what we headed towards. It was a very ambitious mission. It was the first time humankind had left the planet. There were so many things that had to work reliably, but all of us involved were so busy and to concentrate on our job, our role. Even if we wanted to, there was not the time to get into anybody else's job. So everybody relied on everybody else doing their job efficiently and well. It couldn't have worked any other way. And similar comments has been made by the people at Houston and all other participants. So it was our first big mission. We had three stations in the manned spaceflight network specifically designed, built for lunar operation. Ourselves here at Honeysuckle with nearby Tidbinbilla supporting. Similar arrangement in California in the Mojave Desert at Goldstone, and another similar setup in Madrid, Spain. And so between the three of us, we had overlapping coverage most of the time for the full 24 hours. It turned out on this mission that there were some instances where the overlap between Canberra and Madrid got down to quite a small amount. But I don't remember us ever having an outage in coverage, but it became quite marginal. On the way out, I had a unique experience. We lost communications between Houston and the spacecraft. Borman was calling down to Houston, but he couldn't hear the uplink from Houston, and the network supervisor called me on a different circuit and said, call the spacecraft, tell them we'll be with them momentarily. That was the actual word he used. And so I pushed the relevant button on our console and talked up to Apollo 8. I think it was about two-thirds of the way to the moon when this occurred. And only recently did I realise that in that little short conversation I had, it was a world record for a minute or two. There is a recording of the downlink of that conversation, but for whatever reason, we don't have a recording of me uplinking. Anyway, it's in the documentation. Of course, my colleague, Mr. John Saxon, is quite convinced I'd pushed the wrong button, and we've been debating that for 50-odd years. Anyway, I'm quite confident that it was a genuine problem. So that was a unique experience for me on the way out. The other thing on the way out, they had to use a barbecue mode that was rolling the spacecraft so that the heat from the sun was evenly balanced. And so that meant that the communications were intermittent because they had to change the antenna selected on board, one of four, to be the appropriate one for viewing the Earth. And we'd to get used to that. The astronauts had to get used to it. Houston had to get used to it. But it worked out pretty well, and we got the swing of it. On a later mission, mind you, I thought they were sending the command to change the Omnis too early. And so I spoke to Mr. Houston and said, "Hey, I think you're sending those commands a little bit too early." Well, my good friend Ed Fendell leapt on Net2, and who I'd known quite well. He was in charge of communication at Houston. And he yells for the whole of the world to hear, "Hey, Mike, I've got a new display in front of me, and it tells me exactly when to swap the Omnis, Mike, so shut up." So I shut up. There was the whole world listening into this thing. I wouldn't have raised it had I known Ed might get involved. Anyway, the cruise out to the moon was relatively straightforward. We didn't have any problems. I did, of course, have two dishes. Each of those sites, Honeysuckle and Tibbinville, had two transmitters. Each transmitter had two receivers assorted with it. So I had eight receivers at my available in case there were any problems, and I don't recollect any problems. But we had plans to cope if and when anything did play up. So eventually they got to the moon, and we happened to be tracking when they entered moon orbit. That's when they passed behind the moon, and the signal was to the Earth was blocked. And while they were behind the moon, they had to burn the onboard rocket engine to put it into an orbit around the moon. And that was called LOI, Lunar Orbit Insertion. And everybody was on tenterhooks as to how and when it would come out from behind the moon. It could have come out too early, could have come out too late, it could have perhaps not come out at all. But, and therefore there are all these possibilities, but as everything turned out, it showed up at exactly the time expected, and everybody was happy. But Chris Kraft has said, if you weren't worried at that point, you really didn't know what the mission was about. So we tracked those early orbits. They did 10 orbits, which was about 20 hours. So when they were ready to come back, we were also tracking, and the opposite to that LOI burn had to happen. In other words, behind the moon, that to set the rocket motor going again, called the SPS, and if it worked properly, it would come out from the moon at a certain time. Anyway, again, to the rapture of everybody concerned, ourselves and Houston, after the TEI, trans-earth injection burn, it came out from the other side, spot on time. And I think it's Borman eventually comes out and says something like, there is a Santa Claus. It took a little while to establish communications. But in between, we were tracking when they did the Genesis reading in moon orbit. And we received the television of that event. And I've got sort of some Polaroids that were taken there. However, we did not have any way of getting television off station. There was no microwave link, no way of getting the television to the world. However, Goldstone in California was tracking at the same time, and their signal was fed out to the network. So the world could see that in real time, and there's many recordings now available if anybody wants to follow that up. We had really no major problems, except Houston had no idea that we had mountains around the antennas. They'd been used to working with what was called UHF, a different radio system, which was not particularly sensitive to what we call horizon masks. But at Honeysuckle, we'd had quite a large horizon, mountainous surrounds, as did Tidbinbilla. And we're to educate Houston that just because the spacecraft was nominally at 0 degrees elevation, we couldn't get any signal from it. It took a little while for them. So that was the Lunar TV, which was completely successful. Anyway, they cruised back to Earth. There were no problems, no dramas, no difficulties. And the splashdown occurred as programmed. Again, there was some tension when they started the re-entry. But I don't recollect us tracking to anywhere near the actual entry. We did on other missions. So Apollo 8 splashed down eventually, and we all breathed a big sigh of relief. Although maybe we were all young, etc. I never had any qualms about our competence, about other people's competence, about the astronauts' competence. And in retrospect, that was perhaps a very optimistic outlook of everything, because I've heard numbers like a 50% chance of them being successful. How calculated that, I've no idea, and how they did it. But in the end, it was 100% successful, and it did two major things. It kept the Apollo program on track. In fact, it was a major, major milestone for the aim to land on the moon in the following year. And peripherally, it sort of beat the Russians, which, it turns out, was another factor in the background. Not that that impacted any of us workers, but I think it had some political connotations. So there you are. That was Honeysuckle, Tidbinbilla. I should just not forget to mention the other role of the other tracking station in Australia, Carnarvon. Carnarvon had a major role in the Earth orbit phases, in the return phases, and in the translunar injection, the TLI. They were close by then. And in addition, although we were tracking stations, we completely did rely on many, many other players, such as PMG, as it was in those days, Telstra, as it is now, for all our circuits into and out of the station, and for OTC, as it was then, for getting those signals out of Australia to towards Houston and back again. And many people had roles to play, and they all played them successfully. So there you go. That's my memory of Apollo 8.